Likewise.
State of Washington, Court of Appeals, Division 1, is now in session. The Honorable Judge Kieran presiding.
Good morning. Be seated, everyone. First matter this morning is State versus Stephen Hope. Are the parties ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Please, the court. Good morning. My name is Andrew Alsdorf, Deputy Prosecutor for the State of Washington, appellant in this matter. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. Your Honors, in this case, we believe that the court employed the wrong legal standard and therefore abused its discretion by deciding to dismiss this criminal prosecution in the middle of trial instead of investigating lesser remedies that were certainly available to the court. We also believe that this abuse of discretion came in the form of a manifestly unreasonable choice to foreclose the possibility of waiting a few hours, really, to learn from the key witness in the case, Deputy Poole's doctor, just exactly what were the facts and circumstances surrounding his unavailability and how long that availability would last.
How many recesses, I think we do want to draw a distinction, at least I'll ask you that. Do you think we should draw a distinction between continuances and recesses?
Well, the legal authority that I cited, I believe from the Nguyen case, talks about trial continuances and trial recesses in one standard. It's that three-pronged standard of evaluating the validity of the reason, the reasonableness of the time expected for the witness to return, and then a follow-up third prong of analyzing prejudice. So I don't think there is a distinction there.
Does it matter that in one case, when you're dealing with recesses, you've got potential witnesses that are lined up and are supposed to be lined up and ready to go? You've got a jury waiting. The court may, in fact, have other cases that could be tried while the recess has been requested, and it's a waste of court time. Those things don't attend to when the issue is raised prior to trial.
That's all true, Your Honor. So I think that all of those factors that you've mentioned would certainly play into that second factor of what is a reasonable amount of time for the court to sit and wait for this to be resolved when the witness could return. And certainly the prosecutor's office is sensitive to court congestion and a jury's time and the fact that everyone would be waiting for this situation to be resolved. Certainly, this could have gone a lot smoother if the prosecutor had known prior to trial call that Deputy Poole had this serious injury requiring surgery and pain medication that made him essentially intoxicated and incompetent to testify when his subpoena called him to do so. So, but the problem was that the prosecutor forecasted a likely motion for a recess. What his immediate request was to proceed as normal on the morning of the second day.
It was pretty clear that a recess was going to have to occur. I mean, Deputy Poole was not going to come to court that day.
I agree that's the predominant likelihood. I absolutely agree with that. But what was available in that moment at 9:14 in the morning on the second day of trial was the judge's choice. Do we continue with three witnesses who are outside the courtroom, ready to go, ready to testify? As far as the jury knows, there will be no delay. We'll hear all that testimony. It'll bring us to the lunch recess. And by the time the lunch recess is over, we will have that information from Deputy Poole's post-operative appointment, where the doctor could actually provide us with information about, you know, maybe the medication can be adjusted or dosages reduced so that he is less affected by the medication, and maybe he could testify the next day.
Oh, that might be true, but if it is a fact that there would have been, I guess, the second recess that had been requested of the court as a result of this witness's absence?
I think what the court's referring to is the recess that occurred at the end of day one.
That's correct.
Deputy Poole's unavailability was part of the reason for that first recess. There was a whole other independent reason.
Well, the other deputy wasn't available either.
That's correct, and that was a miscommunication.
So how many recesses does the court have to entertain before it's not an abuse of discretion to say no more?
Well, certainly there is a cumulative effect on the frustration of a trial court. I recognize that. But at the end of the day, you have to evaluate each request for a continuance on its own merits and on its own grounds.
Well, it's not just frustration of the trial court, though, is it? I mean, it's not just that the judge is getting irritated. I mean, you've got a jury that's there expecting to go forward. Their time is being wasted.
Absolutely.
You've got witnesses whose time is being wasted and have to be rescheduled. You've got other matters that the court has to attend to. So there's a lot of at stake in each time there has to be a recess, and this is the second one.
We agree, Your Honor. So what I would...
So what's the fundamental principle here that you're relying on? What difference does it make?
Well, the difference that it makes is that dismissal is widely recognized as the most extreme remedy that can be employed against a criminal prosecution.
All right.
And that in this case, there were so many intermediate remedies that the court just didn't look into.
So what do you think, what's the alternate reality here that would have happened if the court had said, okay, Mr. Prosecutor, we will wait till after lunch?
I think
what is there in the record that would have made the judge feel that there was any possibility that that Poole was going to show up?
Well, the only thing in the record is Deputy Poole's own estimate that he would be available the next week. We've attributed the lack of information regarding any medical opinion about how available Deputy Poole might be to the trial court's refusal to wait for that information. But, you know, Deputy Poole himself, as the patient, is a pretty good source of information about when he might be available to testify. And he said next week. And our point is that, you know, we have 13 jurors sitting, hearing this case already. One of those 13, and only one, had expressed what she called some difficulty with the idea that a trial might go into the next week. But that was not an absolute difficulty. You can tell from the record.
So your argument is that it was premature. It might have turned out badly for you anyway if it had gone on for just a little longer. You don't have an absolute right to this. I mean, you might have, if you'd waited till after lunch, you still might have gotten dismissed. You can answer that.
Well, Your Honor, I think if we waited till after lunch, we would have been looking at let's investigate now these intermediate remedies of what could happen next week.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Chris Gibson on behalf of Mr. Hope. We're asking this Court to affirm the trial court's order of dismissal. It did not abuse its discretion in issuing that order. I think this case is very similar to Chichester and Soulgrove. In those cases, you had
you seem to rest on 8.3B, and I had a tough time seeing where the prejudice was to Mr. Hope.
Well, I think the prejudice, had they continued and the facts are, and the court held this, that Poole was not going to be able to testify that week because that was the representation of the prosecutor. You had a jury that was picked and told that the trial would be deliberating on it by Wednesday, July 29th. The actual trial started on the 27th. So you had, they chosen
a
jury.
What's wrong with asking the jury? Ladies and gentlemen, we have kind of an unusual situation here, and I know we told you it was only going to be a couple days, but is there anybody here who could not go home for the rest of the week and then come back next week, bearing all these facts in mind that you've already heard? Is there anything wrong with that inquiry?
There's nothing wrong with that inquiry.
Yeah, we could do that. We can arrange things.
That was a possible path that the trial court could have taken. But you have to look back, and on Friday, the 24th of July, prosecutor and the defense counsel got together and said, we're ready to go to trial. They came on Monday, and they did some minor things, excluded witnesses, and went on to Monday to actually what was going to be the jury case.
Well, and if there were inquiries that could have been made that might have turned out all right for the state, then why isn't this case more like Kerber, State versus Kerber, where the problem was a premature dismissal that might have been might have turned out to be a dismissal anyway, but
because
you just have to make a few more inquiries.
Because in that case, you don't have a prosecutor, the state, repeatedly telling the court and defense counsel, I'm ready to go, I'm ready to go, my witnesses are all lined up, I'm ready to go.
But the word mismanagement never got uttered by the court as the reason for the dismissal.
Well, it was clear to the court that the prosecution had failed to muster its evidence. It had failed to bring its key witness. And they don't need to track everything he does, but when you're telling the court repeatedly, I'm ready to go, and the court relies on that, says, okay, let's pick a jury, then as Judge Spearman pointed out, you are investing a bunch of resources based upon those representations. And by doing so, we now pick a jury. And we don't have the entire record. The state hasn't provided.
Okay, so the prosecutor, you know, they screwed up. They should have been more in touch with Deputy Poole. It seems to me the state's admitting that, too. You know, they should have.
Yes.
You know, but it's you know, there's a lot of should-haves in getting through a trial. I mean, the thing is, this could have been a murder prosecution. And what the rule that you're asking us to adopt would also apply.
Well, I'm asking you to.
The prosecutor forgets to stay in touch with their witness because he's always been so reliable in the past, and then he doesn't show up. And then, I am so mad because you came and told me that you couldn't, that you were all ready to go, and so goodbye.
This is not a murder prosecution.
This is a
stolen vehicle prosecution.
It's a rule.
We are asking this court to find the trial court did not abuse its discretion. It had discretion on how to deal with his case. Chichester and Soulgrove both gave the court discretion to decide that this ineptness by the prosecution has cost us sitting a jury. We've wasted the time of the defense counsel. We've wasted the time of the witnesses. We've wasted the time of the court.
Well, and I guess that's sort of the question. It's not really clear yet what's been wasted, it seems to me, because we don't even know the circumstances of the officer's injury, when the surgery had to take place, why he was on the medication, how long he was going to be on the medication. I mean, it, for example, it'd be different if the injury was like well before trial, and he could have had the surgery any old time, but he just chose to undergo the surgery this week. Mm-hmm. That would factor into whether or not it's reasonable to grant a recess. But if, on the other hand, if it's emergency, the injury just happened, he had to have the surgery, he's on this medication, and he neglects to call in, that presents a very different circumstance. And the judge here did not take the time to learn exactly what the circumstances were that caused the officer's absence, or to learn exactly how long he would have to inconvenience
them. That's only part of the picture, Officer Poole's conduct and his failure to contact the prosecution. But the other side of it is the prosecution's failure to make sure their witnesses were ready to go before telling the court, we're ready to go.
Isn't that the mismanagement issue?
That is 8.3b.
Absolutely.
But if,
and you haven't identified what the prejudice is yet.
Well, the prejudice, again, would be back to the fact that this jury was told, you're going to get the case this week, it's going to be over. We know we had one juror who couldn't go into next week because they said they couldn't do it.
We're talking about prejudice.
I understand. And let me fill in the facts for that. What we don't have and what the state has failed to provide is any of the voir dire. We don't know what the rest of the questions were to the jury in terms of their availability to serve. They were told it's going to be over this week. It's fair to say that the trial court, based upon its knowledge of what had gone on in the entire case, had discretion to say, we're going to have to get a new jury because we're going to lose too many of these people, and that's going to prejudice this client because he's picked a jury. And if we have to pick a new one, his double jeopardy rights are violated. So I think whether we fall under 8.3 or we just extend Chichester and Soulgrove to this situation, you have the prosecution saying we're ready to go when they're not, repeatedly saying they're ready to go, and only finding out later not only was Poole unavailable, but Deputy Gibson was unavailable to testify the first day. They got one witness in the first day. I think this level of ineptness in this prosecution provided the court with the discretion it needs under Chichester and Soulgrove to say that's it.
But the record suggests that the court was pushed over the edge by Poole being absent because he was the key witness. If the phone call is made during the lunch hour and Poole says in response to, the court says it's going to dismiss if you don't get in here today. Okay, I'm not taking any more Percocet, or I won't take any today. I can be there tomorrow off the drugs.
What does that do to it? Yeah. Well, I mean, that's not what the facts were.
There was no formal motion at that point. And that's the point. You don't know factually whether he could have been off Percocet the next day and available to testify.
Well, we have a prosecutor representing to the court that he will not
represented what he had been told.
Yes, and the judge took that at face value on page 89. Well, Deputy Poole's availability has already been determined, basically by your representations of not being available this week. That's what the judge found. That hasn't been challenged.
But wasn't that was the purpose, I thought, of the deputy, the prosecutor asking to go until noon so he could talk to Deputy Poole. After he had seen his doctor, we know the doctor was going to say to him, you've been on these meds too long.
That was
taking
never
off,
part.
It's ibuprofen from here on out.
Right. That was never part of the discussion. The discussion was, we need to find out from Deputy Poole and his doctor when he'll be available down the road. Correct. And it was going to be next week. It wasn't going to be any time during that week. That wasn't part of the discussion. We are already into next week, as the prosecutor represented to the court. And by doing that, we jeopardize this very jury. Now, 8.3, you don't want to find the prejudice there. I think the potential to lose that jury is sufficient prejudice under 8.3. But even if not, Chichester and Soulgrove say, look, at some level of unpreparedness by the prosecution, by leading the court into investing these resources, we've got to be able to draw the line. And this trial court reasonably did so. It exercises discretion to say that's it, whether they want to teach a lesson to this particular prosecutor's office or what.
So what's the double jeopardy issue if you want to, you're relying on that for to establish prejudice?
Well, it becomes double jeopardy if they have to seat a new jury. He picked a jury, had been sworn in, they'd heard evidence, and now we've got unpreparedness by the state potentially requiring a second.
Well, if we don't rule in your favor, then this case goes back. And are you suggesting there's a double jeopardy issue at that point or no?
There may very well be. I haven't thought that through completely. But I think under Chichester and Soulgrove, this court can't reasonably find that the trial court abused its discretion. And I would urge it to affirm the trial court. and if nothing else, because the state has failed to provide a sufficient record to thoroughly flesh out what jurors might have been available to go into the next week. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Two brief points in rebuttal, Your Honor. I wanted to specifically address your question about whether this constitutes mismanagement under 8.3b. And I don't want the court to take my earlier concession that the prosecutor could have made this go smoother as too much of a concession, in that the state, at the end of the day, should be entitled to rely on the subpoena process to bring its witnesses into court. Certainly, we strive for a standard of professionalism above and beyond minimal requirements over 8.3b, and that could have included calls to Deputy Poole prior to trial, confirming once again, did you receive your subpoena, no medical emergencies, you're ready to go, double ensuring all of that. And but that's above and beyond. We should be able to rely on the subpoena process in order to have confidence that Deputy Poole will appear.
I suppose the problem I have with that is you still have to tell witnesses when they're supposed to be there and what time they're supposed to appear. And you can only do that if you contact them and say you're scheduled to testify at 9 o'clock. And it's not unreasonable to expect a prosecutor who's getting ready for trial and who announces, ready, my witnesses are ready, to have done that, and it is a failing. I don't think it's acceptable to simply say, "Well, I've issued my subpoenas, I'm done."
And certainly, Your Honor, I would also like to address the critical issue, which is the third prong of prejudice. The only argument that's been offered from my counterpart is that this is potentially a double jeopardy concern. And there's two points regarding that. One, we don't know if it's a double jeopardy concern because the court never fully litigated or inquired into whether, in fact, this jury was going to have to be replaced with an entirely new jury. Second, while there certainly is a right under double jeopardy law to have your case tried before a specific impaneled jury, that is certainly not an absolute right. That is the end of the discussion. Otherwise, there would be no such thing as retrials or mistrials. At the end of the day, the inquiry fell short of even establishing that a new jury would have even been required. Those are the types of intermediate remedies that case law demands a trial court undertake and inquire into before employing the extreme remedy of dismissal. And we think that was the abuse of discretion in this case.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next matter is State